Welcome to the Half Percent Podcast. My name is Nick Plosser. Each episode is an in-depth interview with a member of our military, whether active duty, reserve, or vet. If you or anybody you know would like to be a guest, please reach out and contact me, Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, the Half Percent Podcast. This show is available anywhere you listen to podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Ricochet Podcast Network, Google Play, Stitcher, YouTube, all of the above. Please subscribe, write us that five-star review, and make us part of your feed. And finally, I want to thank everybody for listening. Really appreciate your time. And with that, let's get into the show.
Okay, Mr. Push-ups, let's hear your story.
It's not just the uniform. It's the stories that you tell. So much fun and imagination.
From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Welcome back to the Half Percent Podcast. My guest today is Greg Coker. Greg spent 30 years in the Army, including a goodly portion of that as a helicopter pilot for the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, also known as the Night Stalkers. Has over 1,500 hours of combat time and 11 combat tours from 2001 to 2007. Mr. Coker, welcome to the show.
Nick, it's just an honor and privilege. Thank you so much for having me on here with you today. And I didn't spend 30 years in the Army. I spent 22 years, but I've got over 30 years of, you know, of experience. And
oh, gotcha. Okay, my mistake.
No. It's all good doing what we do. We never quit.
I was going to say,
yeah, there's always young guys to train and, you know, they take our experience and keep it in-house. So absolutely.
Good enough. Thanks for the correction. Let's get right into this. Why don't you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what made you decide to go into the Army?
Oh, yes, sir. I was a military brat, so to speak. My father was in the military, and I was born out in California where he was stationed. We just, you know, followed him around as a kid and over several years. Came to a point in my life, I was like, okay, I've always wanted to fly helicopters, and I'm going to age myself a bit, I guess, I was a child of the 60s and grew up watching the Vietnam War on TV. So I always had an infatuation, so to speak, of helicopters because it was the helicopter war.
And that's right.
As a kid, drew pictures and those type of things. And then as I got older, I was like, you know, I just, and I talked to my dad quite a bit. He was a 30-year force guy.
Okay.
And retired as a command chief. And I hack on him all the time because I tell him I still outrank him. So,
I'm sure he comes right back to you all at you.
Oh, he does. Well, chiefs walk over water in the Air Force. I was like, I know, Pop. I know. Whatever. Get in the back of the line. So, yeah, he's still going strong, and he's 84 this year. He lives out in over in Arlington, Texas. So we get to see each other quite a bit. But
that's awesome.
So I wanted to fly, and, you know, and he told me, and I didn't have a college degree at the time. So the Army was the vehicle, and they used to have a, you know, one of their commercials, so to speak, was high school to flight school. And you could literally go from high school to flight school in the United States Army. I enlisted in the Army in 1986. And went to the 101st Airborne Division as an infantryman in the 327th. And from there, I always wanted to fly. So I put in a packet. You have to put in your resume to the board and, you know, why they should accept you as an aviator and as a warrant officer into the Army. So I did that. In 1989, I was accepted. And went to flight school at Fort Rucker, Alabama in March 1989. And I tracked Cobras. The AH-1F is a gunship kind of dating myself.
Yeah,
here.
Right.
But
they got a real distinct body though. You really know those things. Yeah.
I tell you, it was a cool machine to fly, and I love flying in the front seat because it's very similar to an F-16.
Oh, right.
You're just sitting out there in air, so to speak, as a front seater.
Yeah, that's right. You're right over the nose in that helicopter, aren't you? You're right there.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Different viewpoint from riding the usual typical helicopter side by side. Yeah, definitely.
Yep. Yeah, sure is.
So what you're just before we get too far in, do you have anything in basic training that sticks out to you? Any drill instructors, sergeants, whatever? Any crazy stories? Anything that brings back?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, my drill sergeant Dufour, I'll never forget him. And he was an infantry guy and just a really cool fella. And of course, I think every basic training from the beginning of probably George Washington, the United States Army, and you know, nothing negatory, but everybody has a private pile.
Yeah, right. No question, man.
And I never will forget this, but yeah, we were out doing Claymore Mine training, and you know, Claymore Mine has stamped on the front toward enemy.
Yeah, it sure does.
This poor kid, I'm not going to say his name because he may come about this one day, but old private, he set that mine up with front facing him.
Oh.
And drill sergeant Dufour, and that we still had steel pots back then.
Yeah.
And, man, he pulled his steel pot off and he threw it at Private Brothers and hit him right square in the face. He had just had all he could take. And of course, it was towards the end, you know, and we were out in the field doing our FTX. And, oh, my gosh, it broke his nose and it just, yeah, it was. But long story short, we never saw Sergeant Dufour again.
At least he didn't get a claymore in his you know.
No.
He saved him a broken nose than a blown up claymore.
Oh yes, sir. And I was like, this guy just you can't make this stuff up.
No,
he was. I mean, we were and we all pitched in to help him, and he got a soap party several nights. And, you know,
it was old.
Back in the 80s, it was still old school basic training. So,
and so how long were you, how long did you, what was the flight training? How long was that to get to like the basic flight training to get you to the point where you could get into the cockpit of a Cobra?
Yeah, it was probably, oh goodness, I have to reach way back. Probably 7 months because we go through what's called, back then it was called WOBC, Warrant Officer Basic Course, and that was 7 weeks. Of just, you know, hazing and get up at 4 in the morning and everything's dressed right, dressed and polished. But no, it was great, great school. And, you know, they were training you to be officers in the United States Army.
Right.
And, and then you go into basic flight. So we flew the TH-55 for a couple weeks and then my class, 89-15, we transitioned to Hueys. So that was what you did all your basic flight with, your solo, great, great machines. And
sorry to interrupt. The Hueys are, that's kind of the iconoclastic helicopter you see from the the Vietnam War and that type of thing, right?
Yes. Yep. Yes, sir. Absolutely. Yeah, it was just cool flying those old machines.
Right.
And our IPs were all, you know, Vietnam vets, and they could make that machine do things you could never even imagine.
Yeah.
But,
unbelievably skilled pilots, and when you have that much combat experience, man, you can.
Yes, yes, sir. Yeah. So, yeah, we flew the Hueys in basic and then did, you know, land navigation, cross-country navigation, then solo, and that was always a hoot. Then you went into instruments, and then you transitioned into your track. So back then the tracks were OH-58, so the scout track, the gun track, which were AH-1 Cobras. The Apache hadn't quite come online yet. It was getting ready to. And then Chinook track.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the tracks. The gun track, the AH-1 Cobra track, was the longest because we had gunnery
mm-hmm.
to learn also. So
yep.
Yeah, it was cool.
The Chinooks are those big. Those are like the big semis of the yes. helicopter world, right? They haul all the large troops and equipment type things. Is that what yep. those do? Okay.
The workhorse of the Army, big twin rotor helicopters.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, we see them every so often. But I think they fly along the coastline here, and so.
Probably.
I think there still are. When did you get involved with the 160th and the Night Stalkers? And just to give people a background, that unit was that formed out of the whole Iranian experience, kind of?
Yes. Out of Desert One.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. After Desert One, Sergeant Charlie Beckwith, Colonel Beckwith, the commander of Delta Force, and he had this very interesting story. And he had requested Army pilots for that mission, but it was multi-service. That's what the hires wanted, and that's what it was. And unfortunately, it was a failure. So immediately after that, Colonel Beckwith went back to Pentagon, back to congressional hearings, and said, look, I told you that we need Army helicopter pilots. So that the actual 160th was formed out of pilots from Fort Campbell, from the 101st.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 1981. And then they started to train for the next operation, which is called Operation Rice Bowl. That was going to be the next attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran. Then President Reagan took over, and right. they released them.
They released them. That's right. That's right.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So, and then is that considered for pilots? Is that like becoming a Green Beret or a SEAL? Is that what that's considered in the 160th?
Yes. Yeah, it's a special operations unit. We support Army Special Operations and some other units.
Did you go through that? So is it Green Platoon? Is that the kind of the Q Course correct. Equivalent? Is that what that?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, correct.
So can you talk a little bit about Green Platoon and kind of what it is and what your experience?
Yeah, sure. A pilot will put in another packet to assess. They have an assessment, and that's your resume. And it's generally mid-range guys. They're senior W-2s or getting ready to be W-3.
Mm-hmm.
And so you submit your resume to the 160th, and then they have a board. They board it. They look at your flight time, your accomplishments. And so from there, they give you a go or no go. And some odd reason I got to go. I was a very junior W-2 at the time, but uh-huh. they took a chance on me because I'd flown a lot of night vision goggles in Korea. My first tour out of flight school was in South Korea,
okay.
flying with the 517 CAV. And at the time, we were the furthest deployed unit. I mean, we were not very far from the North Korean border.
Right.
And that was our mission, to fly and protect that border with armed aircraft.
Okay.
So that was quite an experience for a young W-1 coming out of flight school. So I had quite a bit of night vision goggle time. So that's, that's what they looked at. And yes, I got an assessment and successfully completed that. It's a week long, and there's a lot of things involved with it. And then you go to a board, it's your assessment, and then they give you a go, no go, and you get a go, then they give you a Green Platoon start date.
Okay.
So that was approximately about a year, because I'd gone to the gun company, and again, it just takes longer to train, the guys to shoot the AH-6, which is a civilian MD-530.
Okay.
That the Army buys from Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Hughes, whoever they are today.
Right.
And then they fit them with the avionics that we require, and then the weapon systems.
And yep. and what you mentioned, this is a question from a grounded person, so I don't know the answer to this.
Okay.
What's the difference between flying with the with the night vision and without? And why is that so? Obviously, it's so prized. That's where the Night Stalkers get their names, and a lot of your missions require that. But what's how does that change what you do in the pilot, in the cockpit?
With night vision goggles, number one, we're cheating. Number two is that we see in the night. And and that's, I quite frankly, I did not like flying during the day.
Really?
I just didn't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I wound up with over 6,000 hours of night vision goggles because, you know, we're the night stalkers, not the day stalkers.
That's right. No, no. And it's always, always better to attack when they're sleeping or not ready. Yeah. Right. So,
yes. And that, I mean, night vision and our technology gives us a definite edge over the enemy. And that's, oh goodness. I couldn't imagine doing that like the Vietnam guys, you know, doing stuff during the day and enemy territory. And those guys were just crazy. I mean, they would do night landings into LCs without night vision. I'm like, oh Lord, man, you are kidding me.
But I just was wondering if that's changed kind of how you, obviously it changes how you see and you can see at night, but I just, from a pilot perspective, does that, you know, how does that change from day to night? And it seems like it's the same. It does the same for you as it does for the soldiers that use it, use night vision as well. Yeah. So, okay.
Absolutely.
Doesn't screw you up. Okay, so, and then once you got to the Green Platoon, how long is that whole training?
That, for the gun guys, for the attack guy, which is B Company, 1st Battalion, 160th, there's only one attack company.
Okay.
It was approximately a year for us. And
wow.
You get to a certain point, and then the guys will go to the Black Hawk Company and then to the Chinook Company, and there are two Little Bird companies. So there's A Company, which is the MH6. They're the ones that carry the assaulters or troops. They have planks on the side of their Little Birds.
Yep.
And they can, man, they put those helicopters in places I would never even dream of. And I remember, because I would be circling overhead protecting them as they land on the top of these buildings or, I mean, in courtyards. And I'm like, oh, Lord, please just. Yeah, watch over these guys. I would, but they are by far the best helicopter pilots on the planet. Those Little Bird guys.
Those were the guys that dumped those Delta guys in Mogadishu. Is that those? Was all those?
Yes.
Because when I actually looked at the, you know, was reading that book and looking, I was like, how the hell did they manage to get those guys in there? And they were flying into courtyards, flying into, I mean, that's incredible, man.
It's unbelievable watching them. They're, you know, we're all very close. And yeah, I was just like, oh my goodness, man, don't do that again. You're scaring me. Watch you do all this stuff.
Speaking of Mogadishu, you know, and the infamous kind of Black Hawk Down incident, what, from obviously that was your outfit, right? That flew that. Now were you a part of that? Were you in Mogadishu at that time?
No, I was not. I was in Green Platoon. I got there in 93.
Oh, so just after.
Yes, sir. When they departed and went down. Yep.
How did that incident affect you know your training and you guys? Did that have some reverberations in terms of how you guys looked at training or how you guys did things?
Yes, absolutely. The whole mission was, you know, we conduct an AR, an after action review, and debriefs after every mission we do. It doesn't matter how minor, how large, and so many things came out of that we, lessons learned, so to speak. It didn't affect my class immediately, but it certainly affected Night Stalkers and Rangers and Delta operators, you know, for the rest of, for the future of special operations. Mm-hmm. And we just learned, and simple things for us was that, you know, we used to carry the MP5 submachine gun in the cockpit with us. Well, that is not the weapon of choice because guys needed to shoot, you know, enemy targets out 50, 100, 200 meters.
Yeah, need a little more distance.
Yeah, so we went to the M4 and still carry the M4 with us today.
Okay.
And, you know, just gear and equipment and how we operate. And, you know, nobody goes anywhere without night vision goggles.
That's right. That's so, right.
You know, it's not like, oh, this is a day mission. And, you know, it was ironic that I was shot down on 19 March 2004 in Iraq. And it was the first day mission we'd done since the battle of 3 October 93.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. That's the same. Yeah, I was going to say, man.
I was that guy. I was like, no way, man.
I was going to say, when you got that day mission, you were thinking like, oh, God, do I really want to go on this one?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question our buddies were in trouble. So we, you know, never shall I leave a fallen comrade as part of the Ranger Creed.
Yep.
And, I mean, every one of us were just like, oh, Lord, please just make this fast. We can get in there, kill the bad guys, get our buddies out. And, but yeah, it didn't turn out that way. So
once 9/11 happens.
Yes.
What obviously you're operational. You're guys that do what you do are in high demand at that point, right?
Absolutely. You know, yes,
and did you go to Afghanistan first? Did you go to Iraq?
Yes. No, we deployed first to Afghanistan in 2001, and it changed the lives of all special operators, of all soldiers, airmen, sailors, everybody. And it was pretty interesting, though, and it was an honor for me to be a part of TF SWORD, Task Force SWORD, which was the original Special Operations Task Force that went in. 5th Special Forces Group came in from the north,
mm-hmm.
and then TF SWORD, our task force, came in from the south. So, you know, we wanted to try to compress the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and yeah, man, it was crazy. It was.
Yeah, that's right, because the original couple of ODAs came in. That's right, in the north, and in the south they linked up with Hamid Karzai and that group. So
yep,
yeah. So you,
yeah,
okay,
we.
So
I was actually on the mission that picked up Karzai, and yeah, it was pretty cool, man. Just I got tasked as the fire support officer for TF SWORD. We were in planning, and immediately after 9/11. And we pretty much had a good idea where we were going and who was behind it. And
yep,
that was a no-brainer. So the Delta Force commander approached me and asked me if I would come on as the fire support officer. And I was like, sir, I'm an AH-6 pilot. I want to go shoot some bad guys, you know.
Yeah, right.
But it was the whole part of it was that their fire support officer just left, and so there was a big hole there, and I said, no, I'd be honored to do that, and as long as I'm going, I don't care, man, I'll fly hot air balloons if you want me to. So
that's right.
I just want to go get some.
So so the Night Stalkers are obviously Army pilots, but they also fly for they'll fly other branches as well, right? You guys will give other...
Yeah, a few, not so much. Our priority is Army Special Operations, so
okay.
It's Delta and the Rangers.
Yep.
Yes, sir. Yep. That's the task force for the country.
Okay. And do you train with those soldiers with the Delta and the Ranger guys, or are you just kind of like, it's a crude way of saying it, but like a taxi service? In other words, if they call you, you got to be here and fly these guys here, and that could be anywhere for you, right? Or do you train with specific units for specific
missions?
No, we
train specifically with U.S. Army Special Operations. Yeah, we're a family, and man, we spend so much time together.
Yeah.
You know, when a guy calls on the radio, I know who it is. I mean, I know his voice, and I know that guy's voice and this guy's voice. And if it's up a few octaves, then I'm like, okay, I got to hurry and get
there. Yeah, I was going to say, put the gas on.
Yeah. He needs some fire support very quickly. And I've had that happen. You know,
yeah.
It's tough, and it wears on you. And it's like, man, I know my buddy's in trouble, and I got to get there and help him out. So
we're
all like that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's a hell of a responsibility for sure. You know,
you
do.
You know, and the lift guys, we love each other to death, and the ground guy, again, it's a big family, but we hack on each other. And, right. You know, we're like, nah, man, you're, you know, inside every Chinook guy is an A.H. Littlebird guy just trying to get out. Right. And they're like, you know, the lift guys wear skirts. And, well, you gun guys are a bunch of cavemen. They should put you in glass and say, you know, with a sign, break in case of war, you know. And just things like that. But it's
that's
good,
awesome.
It's good fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's get to when you got shot down. Can you kind of take me through that whole experience in whatever detail you want to give? That's Haditha Dam, or is that area, that time frame?
No, Haditha was end of April, or correction, end of March, first of April in 03. And yeah, it was the biggest battle of the war. And there were, I believe it was 136 of us total on the dam, the Rangers, and there are a few Delta guys, heavy breachers. But yeah, it was, and I wrote a book. I don't know when you wanted to address.
No, this, and I, you know what? That's my fault. I should have mentioned it in the beginning. No, Mr. Coker has a book, Death Waits in the Dark. So we're going to get into that for sure. So yeah, go ahead and talk about it. Yep.
But it's the biggest chapter of the book. And, you know, and I talked to a lot of guys about it, and I was just, quite frankly, I was scared to write this book. Mm-hmm. And these are, you know, these are my deep, dark feelings. And I touch on just everything. And it took me 15 years to write it. And mm-hmm. I prayed about it a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And, as I sent my manuscript out to very select individuals, four-star generals, other guys that I worked with, and every one of them said, Greg, this is a story that needs to be written because there's never been written about the unit like this. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my fears. I'm like, oh, man, I just hope it's accepted. But it's not about me. It's about our tribe. It's about our team, or, you know, all that. And it's mm-hmm. just stories to the best of my recollection. But God put me in so many places.
I was going to say, man, you got a hell of a lot of stories, like, man.
And I was like, okay, but my good friend, Sergeant Major Kyle Lamb, he was a Delta guy, and he's told me for years and years, said, Gravy, that's my nickname. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He'd say, Gravy, if it ain't written, it never happened.
That's right.
And
that's
you right. need to write your story. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so finally, another good friend of mine, former Delta operator, George Hand IV, and I was, you know, I was always talking with him, and he finally got me to sit down a couple years ago and tell him some stories, and then he wrote these stories for Soft Rep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think I wrote 5 or 6 for Soft Rep. Well, they were just, I mean, people were just, they loved them. And they're like, oh, we want more. And so George is like, okay, you son of a gun, it's time to write a book.
Time to do it. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we got her done.
And then take me, talk to me about the incident there where you got shot down, kind of what that whole mission was about.
It was in March 04, and it was just, I was on my, I think, second or third tour, and we had been, we'd been operating in Fallujah, and it was the wild, wild west, man.
Sure was at that time.
03, 04, 05, and doggone, there were just bad, bad people there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd hit, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 targets a night, every night.
Wow.
And, you know, the guys were in gunfights every night. But we gained intelligence off of one target, which led to another target, which led to another target. And so we had a target on the 19th, the morning at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we were like, all of us were like, oh, Lord, not the daytime.
Not the daytime. So,
yeah.
The night stalkers, not the day stalkers.
Yeah, we're not day stalkers. But so the guys, we stayed at the fort, cranked up, ready to go support them. You know, if they got in trouble or needed fire support, then we could be there in just a few minutes to help them. So they got got the dude we were looking for there. And then from, they got more intel for another guy we were looking for, a high value target with Al-Qaeda down in Amarillo, which is about 15 miles south of Fallujah. And so Sergeant Major came back. He says, hey, you guys go to bed and get back to BIOP, Baghdad International Airport, where we were operating out of, because we'd been up going for days, you know. And
right.
So we went back, and then we got a call that the team that went down to Amarillo had gotten into a gunfight. So we ran out to the helicopters. It was about 1 p.m. Iraq time. And, I mean, yeah, it was daytime, but, hey, our brothers were in trouble. They needed us. So off we went and got on station there. They got into a gunfight. And then, yeah, it was the troop commander had called for exfil. So we were all like, whew, okay, let's get out of here.
Let's get out of here. Right.
And it wasn't 10 seconds. An SA-16 shoulder-fired infrared missile hit me in the engine as designed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, everything changed. And
what's that like inside from a pilot's perspective when you get hit like that? Is it, do you hear obviously you hear a loud bang or whatever, but is it jars everything, because those helicopters are they designed to withstand something, or how does that go with you?
No, they're not designed to withstand anything.
Really? Okay.
we have no armor. It's just aluminum and plexiglass and fuel lines and engine and
it's
controls.
It's a small bird. Yeah, it's a small bird.
Yeah. But we carry two M134 Dillon miniguns and two 7-shot rocket pods. And, yeah, it's probably one of the most violent packages on the planet. The guns, yep. Our guns fire 4,000 rounds a minute.
Jeez.
And times two is about 132 bullets per second of 7.62. 308 ammunition, and then of course our 10-pound or 17-pound rockets. But yeah, it was. I never saw it. I was in a climbing right-hand turn. I just flown over the troops there, the ground force, and waved at them. And when the missile hit, and it was a huge explosion. The aircraft vibrated violently in this giant fireball goes right by my right ear. I was in the right seat. And of course you get all the bells and whistles that, you know, the engine's out. And I'm like, I could remember thinking, man, I wish these alarms would shut the hell up, man. I know what just happened.
Yeah. I know what's happening here.
I know what's going on, and you go to work. I mean, your mind, you know, your training takes over, and
that's right.
I'm an instructor pilot. So, you know, I've done hundreds of auto rotations, and that we do those. We train emergency procedures, so in the event that the engine does go out, we can land safely to the ground. And I'd enter an auto rotation. My co-pilot was, you know, in our minds, and we talked about this later. We were in our minds. We were high-fiving each other, because it was like, my wingman told me, he's like, dude, that was the prettiest auto rotation I'd ever seen.
Only another pilot would say, boy, that's a pretty rotation. You're on fire there, but boy, that's a pretty rotation.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on fire the whole time. There's actually a photo that a Ranger took, and you can see me in the air, and I'm on fire. Big fires coming out the back of the aircraft. And I was like, dude, why weren't you suppressing the enemy that shot me down instead of taking pictures?
Yeah, what the hell? Don't take pictures, man.
Yeah. We laugh about it now. He's a good friend.
Yeah, of course.
Ranger Jeremy Smith.
Oh, awesome.
But yeah, I touched down and we slid. And again, I touched down and I must say it was a pretty nice auto. but there's nothing out there, and it's just flat dirt, you know, brown dirt. And we always try to use something vertical around us, you know, trees or a building or wires or whatever, to kind of help help us judge, because there are some things that we have to do as a pilot. You know, we have to start a D cell at 75 feet, and then we hold that, and then at 20 feet, we apply initial cushion with the collective. And then at 15 feet, you level the aircraft, and then you apply the rest of the collective to cushion your landing, and then you just slide it on.
Okay.
And I was thinking that to myself, and it was like a negative from a photograph. It was just frame by frame by everything went to slow motion. And I understand the physiological effects under stress. You know, your adrenaline starts to jump and cortisol and all these magical things start happening to the human body. But yeah, it was frame by frame by frame. And it was really weird to, you know, to see that. But I was doing my job and my training took over. And
I was going to say that all those hundreds or thousands or whatever hours of training really did come in there to save you at that point. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And yeah, I was working pretty hard. and it was, you know, it was all of like, I think 3.2 or 3.4 seconds from the time the missile hit me until I touched down. And we slid about 35 meters. And of course it was in the dirt. And, we went down a bit of a slope and into some soft dirt, and the skid stuck in that dirt, and then it rolled us end over end about three times. You know, just when you think, all right, man, we got this. I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, yes, go get me another helicopter, because I want to find those guys and I'm going to kill them. Right. Shoot me in the back. Right. And so, yeah, the aircraft came to rest inverted on fire, and I came to, and I was like, what is that? My first thought was like, what is that popcorn? You know, it sounded like pop, 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 pop. Well, that was the ammo cooking off.
Oh,
right. Like 18 inches behind me. Oh, and I was like, oh, that's ammo cooking off. Holy cow. Then I thought about the rockets that I was carrying, because, you know, what would they do when they caught on fire? Would they blow up? Would they go off? Or all these things are going through your head. Every man in a violent action like that, you do the check. You know, I check my toes, my feet, my legs, you know, your package.
That's right.
Your arms, your hands, your neck, your head. And it actually had knocked me out in the crash sequence. And I hit the right side of the door frame, and it broke my helmet. And my helmet had a big crack in it. Of course, I didn't know it at the time. But so I looked at my co-pilot, and he had blood all over his face. Bless his heart. And I'm thinking, oh, crap, did he get hit? Did he? And the Little Birds were somewhat famous or infamous in a crash sequence, the shoulder harness not locking.
Oh.
And what would happen is the pilots would kiss the cyclic in that end over end, you know, crash sequence. So that was my first thought. I was like, oh my goodness, he, you know, the guy hit the cyclic.
Yeah.
With his mouth, because he had blood all over his face. And so I just put my hand on his shoulder. Now, keep in mind, we're hanging upside down, right, and this helicopter's burning. Ammo's cooking off, and I can hear bad guys shooting. I can hear our guys shooting. I can hear the other eight shooting. And I'm like, oh, Lord. And, of course, the first thing I thought was Black Hawk down.
Yeah.
You know, here's a little black helicopter shot down 300 meters from the bad guys, and we just stirred the hornet's nest
right in
a very, very bad place. And we called it the Devil's Triangle. So if you drew a line from Fallujah west to Ramadi and then south to Amarillo, that's a triangle. And there had been seven Army helicopters shot down in that triangle.
Wow.
And we were the only crew to survive of all those shoot downs.
Wow.
Yep. But anyway, so I tell my co-pilot, I say, hey, meet me over here. I'm pointing, you know, and he shakes his head. And I said, get out, get out, get out. You know, we're on fire.
And we don't want to get blown up by a cooked off rounds either.
No. So I crawl out. I grab my M4 rifle. And, of course, my first priority is security of the of the aircraft or the our site. And so I did quick 360 degree around that helicopter. Yep, nobody's coming, and I can hear the gunfight going on to the east. So I look back, and I'm like, I'm thinking about my, we carry little rucksacks behind us. Of course, it's got my MVGs, ammo, hand grenades, water, you know, all that stuff you need.
That's right.
And I can, and I thought about a former six-gun pilot. His name's Fred Horsley. And he was shot down in Panama in 1989 during that invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always tell us, you know, he's like, look, fellas, you're only going to get out with what you have on your body or what is with immediate reach of your hands. And sure enough, he was right.
Hmm.
And so my bag was, so I went, I kind of crawled back to the helicopter. I couldn't walk. My right leg wasn't working. And I had a dislocated both shoulders, both my knees were crushed.
Oof.
I had a broken vertebrae in my C spine, broken vertebrae in L spine. Oh yeah, man, it was just groovy as could be.
Oh, and definitely not a walk in the park, brother.
But I got to tell you, man, adrenaline is the best drug on the planet. and it just, I mean, it's like, you know, the bunny, man. You just keep going, you keep going. So I attempted to get my bag, and when I looked at that cargo area, it was engulfed in fire. And I thought to myself, I'm not reaching my hand in there to get that stupid bag, man.
Right.
And then I start to look around, and I'm like, where is the co-pilot? And so I kind of crawl around to the front of the helicopter, and he's still hanging there. And fire, I mean, his left arm is almost on fire. Fire's licking at him. So I said, you got to get out now. And he's kind of looked at me. So I crawled up inside there, and I grabbed his seatbelt latch, and I pulled it, and he went down because we were, you know, upside down inverted, and his head hit the ground. He kind of crumpled to the ground. He looked up at me, and he was like, oh, hey.
I jarred the fog out or what?
Yeah. And I just grabbed him and I jerked him out of that aircraft because I'm like, my God, he's going to burn up in there, you know, yeah. If I don't do something. Yeah. And then, so we got out, got about, I don't know, 30 meters from the helicopter. And it was just, cockpit was fully engulfed and ammo was cooking off. And then I heard a vehicle start to head toward us. I couldn't see. We were set up in a bit of a defilade. And I put the other guy facing north, and I was facing east towards bad guys. And I was up on my knee, and then I heard the vehicle stop. And then I saw this guy running, and I saw a ball cap, and then I saw a face and a beard. And I'm like, oh, I know him. Oh, he's my brother. That's Chaz. He's coming to get us.
Probably the happiest you've ever been to see that dude.
Yeah, yeah. And he grabbed us and hugged us, and he told me, he's like, man, we thought you guys were dead. I said, we ain't dead. And he looked at me, he goes, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go find that guy, and I want to kill him.
Yeah.
He goes, get in the truck. So we got in the gun truck and five vehicles. We assaulted the – they saw the shot. Two guys actually saw the missile shot.
Okay.
Saw the building where it came from. So, yeah, long story short, we spent the next 6 hours in a gunfight, and yeah, we finally got back to Ramadi, and where one of our Blackhawks, 160th Blackhawks, picked us up and took us to the hospital, and the rest is history.
I was gonna say, man, you took a little 6 hour detour to get some back, but with two dislocated shoulders, vertebrae, and knees, man, you were right. Adrenaline is a hell of a drug.
Yeah. Of course, we had a doc with us, and he worked on us constantly.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course.
We're in this assault. We got machine guns going. Everybody's fighting bad guys, and our truck gets stuck in a mud. Oh, I'm like, of course, you know, I look up. I go, okay, Murphy.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's
no right. More, Mr. Murphy, please.
He will always appear right when you need him least.
He raises his ugly head. It's like my auto, you know, get on the ground. It's all good. And then I'm like, uh-oh, this isn't good. Oh, goodness gracious.
Well, did you have any other, obviously you had a bunch, but anything that kind of sticks out from Iraq and then later Afghanistan?
Man, it was just nonstop, you know, for us. Because
your tempo was real, real heavy, I would imagine.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And you know, all the other units, they'll have like three battalions or three squadrons or, you know, with lots of guys there. But for the 160th, A Company and B Company, the Little Bird companies and the Black Hawk guys and the Chinook guys, I mean, there's only like 25 of us that can do what we do.
Okay, I didn't know it was that few, man. That's a
maybe on a good day. And that's if nobody gets hurt, wounded, or killed in action. And man, it was just, oh my goodness, it just killed us. The op tempo is what they call it, the operational tempo. And you know, but we did what we could do.
Yeah,
and that's just how we are. And you know, we stayed in a fight.
And you got a lot of good people counting on you, so I know that's a hell of a motivator for sure. What? How long did that tempo last, or that particular, after you were injured? Obviously, you needed some time to heal, right?
Yeah, I wasn't right, I guess, and my docs were like, "No, we're not doing this." I said, "Yeah, we're doing this," but so I was grounded for a little while, but what I sat down with our surgeons, our regimental doctors, and got a plan. I said, here's what I want to do. You know, once my head, I had a severe traumatic brain injury from impacting that door frame, and we need to let it heal. So I told them, I said, well, I'll get surgery on my shoulder, surgery on my knee, and then I'll deploy again. And then when I get back, I'll get another surgery on a knee, and then I'll deploy again. When I get back, we'll fix my lumbar spine, you know.
Piece by piece, man.
Yeah. And oh man, they were upset with me, but I told them, I said, look, fellas, this is my job. This is God's purpose for me. And just, you know, they trust all of us, all the men in those units, that if we're not fit for duty, we'll tell them. Mm-hmm. That we're not fit, and because that I continue that until late 2007.
That's an interesting issue, because you know that's obviously an issue with, you know, mental health and especially with guys that do the job that you do, which is such a high op tempo. And did you for the pilots, is, you know, is that encouraged in terms of if you feel like you're getting gassed out, you're not sleeping enough or whatever, if you're injured or whatever, is that encouraged, or are guys a little hesitant because they're afraid they'll be grounded, or how's that, that pressure?
No, not at all. And every man, Jack of us were, you know, we're all dedicated to the mission, and you know, one of our sayings was, well, we can rest when we're dead. Right now,
<That's true. laughs>
this is the only war we got.
That's
and
right.
Little did we know at the time that it would last as long as it did. But yeah, it's extremely taxing on a human being. And you know, I was 43 years old when that happened.
Mm.
And I mean, the mean age of any of those, you know, any of us at that time was probably 38, 39 years old. So, but we're in top physical. I was in the best shape of my life ever at age 43. I was, man. I could run, I could lift, I could, and that's just who we are. Mm-hmm, and we certainly didn't want to be a liability ever. And, you know, we're all shooters and we train hard. And not only do we fly, but, you know, we do many other things also. But yeah, it just wore you out.
And
the boss walked up to me one day and he put his arm around me and he said, Gregory. And when he called me Gregory, Lord.
That's like when your mom uses your full name, man.
Oh, yeah. Gregory Scott. Man, I still get those chill bumps. I'm like, uh-oh. Yeah, I'm 60 years young now. And I was just like, ooh. Or if I hear a belt come through belt loops, I was like, ooh. Still today.
Yep,
But he looked at me and he's like, I think it's time for you to go home. What? I said, Roger, you've been all you could be. I said, yes, sir. And I got to a point where I was a liability because I was hurting and I need more surgeries. And yeah, I had over 30 surgeries and I have over 40 pieces of titanium in my body.
Jeez.
So yeah. Yeah.
They've gotten a pound of flesh out of you and then some.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. You know, a piece of me was ready to go for my family and my kids' right. sake. But man, there was that other piece. I was like, doggone. I just, okay, Lord, I got it. So that was his message to me.
Father Time and Lord the Father, those two will get you every time.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
So you, once you came back in 2007, you just got out of the Army completely or just stopped?
Yeah, I retired.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yep.
And then you guys are, the 160th, are they stationed at Fort Bragg or where's their home base?
No, sir. Our regimental headquarters and 1st Battalion and 2nd Battalion are at Fort Campbell.
Okay, Fort Campbell.
And then there's 3rd Battalion at Hunter Army Airfield in Fort Stewart, Georgia. And then there's 4th Battalion out at Fort Lewis, Washington.
Okay, okay.
Yep.
And so you were living around, obviously, on base at the time. And then what? Yes. Once you retired, obviously, someone with your experience and skill is not gonna be long for. There's gonna be some civilian, I would imagine, other military law enforcement opportunities. Did you have an eye towards you wanting to teach or continue to train or what was absolutely. After that?
Yeah, I linked up with my good friend, Sergeant Major Kyle Lamb, Viking Tactics, and I was a firearms tactics instructor with him for quite some time. And then I have my own company. It's called Shield 91, mm-hmm. and I worked with school districts, safety and security, emergency response. Yeah, worked in the oil and gas industry for a while. And yeah, I did my own thing.
Yeah.
And I just enjoyed teaching, and I flew, still did some flying. I did some engineering work for Dillon Aero that manufactures the M134 minigun,
mm-hmm.
To make those better, mm-hmm. just help them, with better weapon systems and technologies that would help the guys that would come after me. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And looking back, obviously you're proud to have been a part of the Night Stalkers, but
Oh yeah, man.
And I'm sure you guys are a pretty tight knit group still, I would imagine.
Very.
And, Very. Yeah. So now let's get to this book. You mentioned you were hesitant to write it for, obvious reasons. That's one of the reasons I reached out to you is just cause there's not a lot of firsthand accounts of
yes.
people who do that job. How did you kind of get over the hesitancy of writing that? And, you mentioned your friend saying, hey, if someone doesn't write it, it doesn't happen. But what were other things that were kind of stumbling blocks for you?
Well, my wife, Edie, was my biggest inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I told you earlier, I prayed about it a whole bunch and
mm-hmm.
God said it was okay to do this. So, but One evening, she looked at me and she says, hey, this is, because we were talking about writing. And, of course, George had, I've been writing some stories for Soft Rep with him. And
mm-hmm.
she goes, look, here's how I want you to attack this. She said, write this story for your children and your grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think she and George were conspiring anyway.
I'm sure.
But that really stuck. And I mean, we have 6 grandchildren, 2 more coming,
awesome.
But that really stuck with me. And I said, okay, I can grasp that and I can put everything else aside and I'll start writing. But I started a journal on 9/11 on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote in it every day for 8 years. Luckily, I had that. And I mean, I wrote the book in less than 90 days.
Wow.
But that's, yeah, and everybody was like, what? Man, yeah, I've been writing a book for 2 years.
I was going to say, man, anybody who's done that process, and I have, that's quick, man. You were focused, man.
So, I got focused, and I just sat down, and I, you know, like any good special ops guys, you write a plan, you write a mission brief, here's what I'm going to do, and I bounced it off. George was my co-author. He likes to call himself a ghost writer. I said, there's nothing ghost about this, George. Exactly. So, I mean, he's just a great guy. He's one of the most intelligent human beings I've ever met. He speaks like 7 languages, to include Mandarin Chinese. and he's just I just love him to death.
That's awesome. How can people kind of, you can go deathweightsinthedark.com. I'm on the site now. Yeah. Everybody go get it. But how else can people get your book?
Yeah, we've got a Facebook page and an Instagram, but the website, and I'd just like to, thank the team that helped me. Of course, George Hand IV, and the cover of the book, there's a story behind it, because we wrestled with that, because that needs to reach out and grab you.
Yeah. It's a cool cover too, by the way. We'll put it up on on the Instagram and all that, but it's a cool cover.
Well, there's a print that was done by Rob Wentz, retired CW4, Rob Wentz art, and he did a print for the 6 Guns for B Company. Mm-hmm. We had an old print. It'd been around for years and years, and Rob did one, and the print hangs in my office here, and I'd look at it every day.
Nice.
And I was like, crap, there's the book cover right there.
Right.
So I contact Rob. He used to fly Blackhawks in the 160th. So he's a unit guy, and just a beautiful, wonderful art that he does. And so I call him. I was like, hey, bro. I said, man, I want to ask you a question. I've got your 6 Gun print, and I'm looking for a book cover. He goes, yes.
Before he even got it out.
I said, what? He goes, no, man. He said, I would be honored. And I said, I want to use the print for the book cover. And, again, he says, man, Greg, I would be honored. And then the other part of that team was Lori Gaff, the graphic artist that put the rest of the cover together. And we're all just real proud of that. But and everybody says, man, that cover's going to reach out and grab you.
So. Yeah, it pops, man. It really does. I remember saw a little thumbnail of it when your Instagram page first got up, and I was like, that looks pretty cool, man. And then those are Night Stalkers. And so that's what made me, that's what first grabbed me, to be honest. So, it's also a great title too. That's also what grabbed me. So.
Yeah, it jumped out. And I'd really done a lot of research, and first I was like, man, this surely, because that's one of our mottos, death waits in the dark.
That's right.
For the Night Stalkers. And I'm like, man, I know this has probably got copyright, and da, 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 da. And
yep.
So I'm researching the legal aspects of it. And I call the unit and talk to them. They're like, because I wanted to use the Night Stalker DUI, the Distinguished mm-hmm. Unit Insignia. And mm-hmm. he's like, no, man, it's not copyright. And that's not copyright. So I'm like, okay, roger that. So there's the name of the book.
Did you have to submit this to the Army at all for looking over or anything like that in the process?
Well, I submitted it to the 160th to, look at, and I told them, I said, hey, if there's anything that jumps out, and it was a process. I mean, George being a Delta guy, and that was something that I was truly, truly very concerned about, is, I didn't want to put out any of our TTPs, tactics, techniques, procedures,
that's right,
or anything classified. But it's been triple checked, so to speak, but mm-hmm. everything I write about in the book is open source.
Yeah.
And, uh-huh. You know, and I kind of go back to Tom Clancy in his first book.
Yep.
You know, he wrote it, and President Reagan sent the Secret Service and the FBI to his house. It was like, hey, where did you get this stuff? Exactly. And he's like, it's open source, man. So
that time, he's like, I haven't even seen this yet. Where'd you get this? But, right?
Yeah. And, you know, later on, they became good, good friends.
That's
and
right.
Wife. But,
that's right.
But I was, yeah, we really spent a lot of time, and some stuff got taken out because I felt it was right on the edge, and mm-hmm, you know, I didn't want to put any of that stuff out there to, yeah. So
what,
yeah.
Before I let you go, I kind of want to, working with those so closely with those Delta guys and everything, and obviously that's the, you know, the elite of the elite, and
yes,
what in your mind separates you know, the pilots, and this is, I don't want you to ask you to brag about yourself. You're welcome to, but I don't, that's not the purpose of this question.
No.
I'm just always curious at humans who operate at that, that high level. Cause they're, you know, they're the best at what they do.
Sure.
What separates those guys? Is it in the mind, or is it a combination of everything, or?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I've told guys just coming in or in conversation with other men, and I've always said this, that the man doesn't pick his profession. The profession picks the man.
Hmm.
And that's the draw. And I really wish somebody would study it, because I've met, and I go into this in the book, but I mean, some of the most highly intelligent human beings I've ever met in my life. I know guys that went to MIT and they're door kickers in a special operations unit.
Right.
And
right.
They've been to Rose Holman. They've been to Ivy League schools. And here we all are in this merry band of men out serving our country and the good citizens of America.
Mm-hmm.
And it just always interested me. But I've also said, listen, when men would question their destiny or what they were doing, I said, listen, I'm a very faithful man, and it says in the Bible that when God is knitting us in our mother's womb, our path is already laid out.
Mm.
you may bounce left and right, but right. Here we are. You know,
you're going to stay on that road eventually, right?
Yes, right. Absolutely, right. And I truly believe that. But you know, where in the world does, you know, all these great men come together? And I always say, you know, I wasn't a great soldier, but I sure did serve with many.
Yeah.
And it was an honor to walk with giants. And
yep.
those men are my heroes. They are giants, and God bless them. I mean, doggone, it's tough. It's tough on a man. It's tough on their families, their kids. And yeah. I write about that. I really do.
Yeah,
I go into
definitely.
Depth and detail.
Well, yeah, you're among those, and I'm sure they thank you every time you fly overhead when they need you. They better
like,
be buying beers for you.
Yeah, they're like, brother, I sure was happy to see you, man. I was like, yeah, that's what we're the archangels, bro.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's Mr. Coker. Thank you so much for your time, man. I will link all this up. Obviously, your website and how people can go get your book. And I think you mentioned to me that some of the proceeds of this book are going to something that you support. I think you mentioned that.
Yeah, all of my proceeds are going to nonprofits that support veterans, first responders, and their families.
Awesome.
I'm not putting a dime in my pocket. So that's just, you know, that's where it's going.
I salute you for that. That's a, you know, you're doing it for the right reasons, man. And I'm sure every bird pilot out there will appreciate you telling, you know, one of their own telling the story, as opposed to some guy sitting in West LA writing about
yeah.
never fired a BB gun in anger, man.
Yeah, so, sure. I always thank those that haven't served, and they'll say, well, I didn't serve. I said, oh, yes, you did. Absolutely, you did. You know, you went to work every day.
That's
you did what God had intended for you to. You prayed for us every day.
And that's right.
No, you did serve. So don't ever think that. You know, there's less than 2% of the population that serve.
That's right.
So those, you know, and then there's like, it's 0.2% that serve where I serve.
Where you did.
So, that's right. Yeah, so I'm like, it's all good, you know.
I always tell people that come up, you know, when I talk to them about doing this podcast and interviewing the people I did, I was supposed to go in the Marine Corps in 2004 and partially ruptured a disc in my back, so that was out. And I talked to people and I said, hey, listen, man, at the end of the day, we're all going to work to pay the taxes that go to pay for that stuff and pay their salaries.
That's right.
So, you know, we all try to, as you say, we all do what God gave us the ability to do, right? So
the good taxpayers of the United States of America buy us bullets and gas.
That's
we go get the bad guys.
That's right. That's right. Some just do it at a very higher level like you guys. That's it.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you bet.
All right, Mr. Coker. It was a real pleasure to talk to you, man. And thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time for me.
Thank you. God bless you.
God bless. All the best.